Tell Us Another, Stories That Never Grow Old, by Winifred Herbst, SDS. Published by the Society of the Divine Savior. St. Nansian, Wisconsin. Neil Obstadt, Greg Rybrook. De Pere, Wisconsin. Imprimatur, Paulus Petrus. Eps Sinus Virdis. Green Bay, Wisconsin, June 12, 1925. Permissu Superiorum. Dedicated to all whose sublime calling it is to mold the plastic hearts of youth after the heart of Jesus, the Savior of the world. Preface. It was in a schoolroom in which I had before told many a simple story. Asked by eager boys and girls to tell another, I replied, "What shall it be? I have already told so many." "Oh," they exclaimed, "tell them over again. We could listen forever." That was high praise, too high. But the thought contained in that remark gives the reason for this little book's bold venture into existence. It is just a book of stories told over again, for the most part. Some few, indeed, are original in every way. All, of course, are original as regards the way of telling, and they are told in language that cannot but prove helpful to the careful reader. They are goodness stories. They whisper to the heart of virtuous conduct, of kindliness, of fair example. That is what they are sent out for, to tell another, and yet another, to those hearts that are so open to every good suggestion, the hearts of our dear boys and girls. May God bless the readers. The author. Salvatorian College, Feast of St. Monica, 1925. Marie's Rosary. The lovely stars of early night were all a-twinkling in the glorious May sky. Marie Leslie, kneeling at the window of her little room, gazed rapturously upon the delightful scene. Down below was the blooming garden with its fragrant trees mirrored in the stone-encircled pond. Further on, a leafy grove threw somber shadows as the moon, big and nearly full, peeped slowly over the treetops, gushing out a flood of silver light. Marie was praying. 'Twas her evening prayer. But now, because it was May, a decade of the rosary was lovingly added. How easy it was to pray to nature's God, with nature all a-smiling before her. Arising, she kissed the cross of the neat little mother-of-pearl rosary in her hand. "My first communion rosary," she murmured softly, as she unconsciously dropped it upon the sill and cast a last look at the starry heavens above. "Queen of May, oh, pray for me." "Mother dear," cried Marie upon entering the kitchen early the next morning, "did you take my rosary away? I cannot find it anywhere, and only last night I had it in my room." No, mother had not taken it, nor had she seen it anywhere. "Perhaps Eddie has it," she suggested. In a moment, Marie had found her brother. "Now don't you begin to tease again, Eddie, but tell me where you hid it, my first communion rosary." "Really, Marie, honest now, I didn't take it. I didn't even see it," said Eddie. "You'll soon find it somewhere, I'm sure, don't worry." And for once, Eddie looked so very innocent and sincere that Marie could not but believe him. But search as they would, it could not be found. Turning everything topsy-turvy, to mother's great discomfort, they explored the entire house and even the lawn around it. It was in vain. At last they gave up, but not to fret and complain. Oh, no, Marie was too truly a little lady for that. Beckoning Eddie, she whispered mysteriously into his ear, "Come up to my room with me. I have a wonderful plan." Up they went. Eddie's curiosity was wide awake. What was about to happen? Closing the door quietly, Marie said with a bright smile, "Eddie, let's pray to Mother Mary, asking her in some way to bring my rosary back to me. The fifth joyful mystery, the finding of Jesus in the temple, is the best." Kneeling in simple faith, gazing fervently upon a picture of Our Blessed Lady which hung over Marie's little white bed, and using Eddie's rosary, they trustfully prayed, "Hail Mary, full of grace." 10 times their sweet little voices chimed out the beautiful prayer. Then they arose, joyful, confident. "'Twill surely, surely come back," maintained Marie. "Our Lady's help is never asked in vain. Remember, O gracious Virgin Mary. Now we'll wait. I'll get another rosary from Sister for the time." And away they went for a game before school. October days, the sweetest of the year, had come. Clad in autumn's many-colored garb, the woods presented a beautiful sight. In the fields, yellow pumpkins shone amid rugged shocks of golden-eared corn. All nature was aglow with the russet and gold of Indian summer days. 'Twas Mary's month again, the month of the Holy Rosary. "Eddie," said Marie as they sported about in the frost-painted grove, "it's the 1st of October. I'm sure my rosary must come back soon. It simply must. Doesn't the memorare say, 'Never was it known'?" Marie was ever thinking of her rosary still. She was waiting patiently and trustingly. "Perhaps," Eddie ventured to say, "you'll never find it." "There's no perhaps to it," replied Marie with a sweet sauciness. "It's sure." And laughing lightly, she added, "Let's pick a museum of leaves, all colors and sizes and shapes." This they at once proceeded to do. Suddenly Marie called excitedly, "Eddie, Eddie, come here. There's a lone robin's nest high up in this tree. And see, there's something shiny in it, something bright. Maybe it's a jewel." Eddie peeped through the brownish leaves. "Sure enough," he burst out, "I'll have it down in a jiffy. What if it's a real gem?" he added, his eyes glistening with excitement. With squirrel-like agility, he climbed the tree. "Now I have it," he cried, standing on a long branch and reaching out for the nest. "Catch it, Marie, down it comes." Down it came, falling on the velvet grass at Marie's feet. As she stooped to pick it up, an exclamation of surprise and joy escaped her lips. Then, kneeling beside it, she breathed a grateful prayer. "Oh, thanks, my darling mother, Queen of the Holy Rosary." For there, neatly interwoven in the robin's nest, completely encircling the inner side, was a string of pearls, Marie's first communion rosary. Bernard's Thanksgiving Day. "Bernard, I wouldn't advise you to risk it today. The lake is frozen over, that's true, but it may hold you along the shore, but further out it's mighty thin, and you might go through. 'Twere better to stay away. I don't trust this rubber ice, not I." Thus spoke Farmer Williams to his son. It was the 25th of November, cold and frosty. The preceding night had been bitterly cold, and everything now lay clasped in winter's chill embrace. The nearby lake presented miles and miles of dull white and blue. It was a frozen mass, so it seemed from a distance. Bernard Williams had been sharpening skates and making a great fuss generally in looking for straps and such like things. But now his father had spoken. It was like pouring cold water over a hot stove, so quickly did his enthusiasm cool off. In the kitchen some moments later, he told Annie all about it. "He didn't forbid it," he added, after telling of his father's admonition. "He merely said, 'I wouldn't advise it, and so I'm going anyway. After our magnificent dinner at Grandmother's, I'll just skip down to the lake and cut some figure eights.'" "You're surely a goose if you do," said Annie with sisterly bluntness. "Oh, you are a goose too," rejoined Bernard, half angrily. "Then we are both geese, and we are certain to get ourselves eaten at Grandmother's Thanksgiving dinner," laughed Annie good-naturedly. She said no more, for what can a sister do with a big, headstrong brother? 'Twas 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Bernard Williams, sitting on an old log behind a clump of willow bushes on the lake shore, was putting on his skates. The ice was splendid, smooth as glass and just as transparent. "Oh, how fine!" exclaimed Bernard as he rose and made a number of fancy cuts and 20-foot strokes. "Now for some fun, miles of it. Out you go, Benny." The ice was thin, he noticed. How it sometimes cracked! How rubbery it seemed to be at places! "Where it sags, it never breaks," cried Bernard as he sailed along. All unconsciously, he had gone out further and further, and then, as he turned back to look, he uttered a cry of surprise. There was the shore, fully a mile away. He looked through the clear ice. Dark and deep was the water below, and how very thin the ice seemed to be! 'Twas only an inch thick, he could tell from the air bubbles. The vast expanse of ice was everywhere cracking. There were the sharp, plunging cracks and the dull booms, as is always the case on a cold, sunny day. As he stood gazing at the shore, there was a sharp running sound, and he saw a little streak of water glimmering between him and the land. "It's a crack," he exclaimed. "Can I cross it? And if not..." With startling vividness, his father's words came to him. "Bernard, I wouldn't advise it. Bernard." How full of love and fatherly care that one word had been. "I wouldn't advise it. I wouldn't advise it." So the strokes grated on his ears as he glided towards the shore. He had reached the crack. 'Twas 2 inches wide, he noted. The water, bubbling over, covered the ice 3 feet on either side. As he neared the crack, the ice sagged. He started back aghast. His heart pounded in his ears. "I wouldn't advise it. I wouldn't advise it." He swallowed hard. An awful feeling of fear gripped him. "I'm lost if I go through," he exclaimed, trembling. "Dear God, I'll never disobey again. Guardian angel, oh, help me." He looked about for help. No one was in sight. And how could anyone have helped him out there on the thin ice? "I must try a quick slide," he muttered weakly as he went back for a start. "Guardian angel, help me now." He was crossing, but he felt himself sinking slowly, slowly. Then his right skate caught the opposite edge of the cracked ice and he fell. In went his right foot. Already the icy water was up to his knee, and still he felt himself sinking, sinking. 'Twas an awful moment. "Guardian angel," he cried, "help, oh, help me." At that moment new strength seemed to be given him. Pulling himself up as best he could, he made a last desperate effort and threw himself forward. "And God be praised," he cried chokingly as he slipped out upon the smooth ice. "I'm safe." 10 minutes later he was on shore, removing his skates with trembling hands. Bernard is a man now. Since that eventful Thanksgiving Day, 1906, he has ever valued his father's advice. Time and again he has said, "My guardian angel saved me then." Florence's Christmas. Yes, there's happiness in goodness, if there's happiness anywhere. Within the hidden sweetness of a good deed, there lurks a joy, not indeed of earth, but of heaven. God, infinitely good, is also infinitely happy. Oh, for an unceasing round of little deeds of kindness and little words of love. All this Florence Simon experienced of a beautiful Christmas morning. Merry Christmas was on the lips of all. The densely filled cars bore it along, the hurrying crowd scattered it with profuse cheerfulness. Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas. Florence stood at the parlor window of her neat little home on Hancock Street and gazed upon the scene of Yuletide merriment. She was all dressed and ready for church. St. John's was only 6 blocks away. How very happy she seemed to be! Surely it was because of Mass, communion in the crib. For what is like a Christmas Mass? What like Christmas communion with its blissful thanksgiving before the omnipotent Babe of the crib? Or were her thoughts happily occupied with Christmas gifts, with sweets and goodies, all encircling a fragrant tree? Oh, no. In years gone by, they, too, had seemingly helped to make her joy more full. But today, Florence had neither gifts nor tree. She had them not because she loved Christ's poor. "Mother," she had said 3 days before, "Sister Mary told us today of Jesus's poor. Of those little ones who will have naught for Christmas. Many," she said, "will have a lone and dreary Christmas, no presents, no sweets, no Christmas dinner, not even Christmas joys. To give to such as these, she told us, would be to place a gift into the very hands of the smiling Christ child. Mother dear, please, oh please, pack all my gifts, my sweets, away. Distribute them among the poor mothers of Harcourt's Lane. The boys and girls, you know, are all awaiting the Christ child's coming. How happy they will be then, how bitterly disappointed otherwise. Mother, I want nothing. I want only Jesus and his love. I want to give something to Jesus. Come now, Mother, won't you, dear? How very pleased her mother had been. But Florence, would you really like it? Would you be truly happy? Oh, yes, she had answered. I cannot otherwise be happy. In the crib, little Jesus stretches out his baby hands to me. Can I say no to him? Oh, I cannot. I may not, nor do I wish to do so. Never fear, I'll be happy, Mother. I'll get more than the whole world, with all its holy Christmas joys. Jesus in Holy Communion. And so it was Christmas morning, and Florence was without the usual books and parcels and goodies, without a Christmas tree. It seemed strange indeed, yet still more strange was the peculiarly happy sensation which gently thrilled her through and through. She was more light-hearted and cheery than she had ever been before. 'Twas happiness and goodness, only this she knew. And in St. John's the Mass was, oh, so wonderful. Father Hubert's voice trembled with holy emotion at the angelic Gloria in Excelsis Deo. How the organ pealed in accompaniment to a mighty volume of stirring song. And then her communion. Never had it been so full of rapturous sweetness. Never had Jesus spoken so tenderly to her loving heart. He seemed to come to her as a little child, to kiss her with soft baby lips, to cling to her confidently with his tiny arms. After Mass she knelt long and devoutly before the crib, almost hidden as it was in a miniature evergreen grove. Her heart was well nigh bursting with gratitude. "My infant Saviour, sweetest, gentlest Jesus," she whispered softly, "I've never been so happy before. Oh, how can I ever thank you, dear Christ child? I have all my Christmas gifts in you." Still a-burning with love and full of happiness found in goodness, Florence returned home about 30 minutes later. What was her surprise to find nearly all the boys and girls of Harcourt's Lane awaiting her. "Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas!" Again and again, amid the ringing of joyous laughter, the hearty greetings were exchanged. A Christmas tree all ablaze with lights and a glimmer with tinsel stood in the center of the parlor. Ruddy apples and yellow oranges glowed among the odorous branches of green. And what a heap of bags and bundles of books and games, and what not there was at the bottom! Florence was amazed. She looked at the smiling faces of her happy young friends, knowing not whether to laugh or to cry out of sheer joy. But just then, her mother and Uncle John entered the room. Wealthy Uncle John, the Broadway banker. He smiled at Florence's surprise and bewilderment. Then, turning to her mother, he said, "Tell her about it, Mary." "My dearest Florence," said her mother, and she accompanied these words with a kiss. "On Christmas Eve I told Uncle John of your wish to give all your gifts to the children of Harcourt's Lane. Now, you know, Uncle John loves both the poor and the lovers of the poor. So he played the part of the bountiful Christ child in their regard. He made this Christmas one which will ever be remembered by your young friends here as the very happiest of their lives. Yes, he simply heaped the choicest of gifts and the most useful of presents upon them. More than this, he bade them bring this beautiful tree and all these pretty things to you. Now, dressed in their best, they have come to make your Christmas the happiest of the happy, the merriest of the merry. Florence, dear, there is truly happiness and goodness, isn't there? So, my dear children," she added, addressing the shining faces around her, "laugh and chat and sing and feast all day long. Now, for a Christmas breakfast, Then for a Christmas dinner, peace on earth to men of goodwill, peace and joy. You see, Florence, said Uncle John, with one of his big, hearty smiles, the child Jesus has already given back all that you gave him, hasn't he? Oh, 1,000 times more, murmured Florence. She was thinking of the joy of giving. Wasn't it greater than the joy of receiving? Although that, too, was very great. A Beautiful Legend Retold. Will you listen to a little story, to a beautiful legend? It takes but a moment to tell it. When our first parents, Adam and Eve, were expelled from the wonderful garden of paradise, they roamed sadly about. All around them there were but thorns and thistles, and the bare and cheerless earth. Filled with grief, they tearfully exclaimed, "Oh, that the angel who stands at the gate of paradise had, with his flaming sword, put an end to our existence!" And they wept. But now they seemed again to see paradise, and to hear gentle breezes rustling amid the beauteous leaves of its shady trees. They thought to hear again the happy ripple of its laughing brooks. Then it was that a pure white, rose-tinged cloud appeared to them. From it a sweet voice spoke, saying, "Weep not, for I will always be with you. I will make smooth your path, lighten your labor, make your darkness bright. When you till the earth by the sweat of your brow, I will show you in the distance refreshing shades and waving fields. I will show you paradise." "But will you also help us when we come to die?" asked the weeping couple of the little voice in the milky cloud. "Ah, yes," came the response in musical tones. "I will also then be with you. Then, too, will I disclose paradise to you. Nay, more, I will lead you back to it." In joy and wonder the exiles then exclaimed, "Oh, who are you that make us thus happy?" "I," came in accents low, "am Hope, the daughter of Faith and Charity." Then the cloud melted away in the soft summer air, but Hope dwelt with them ever after, and our first parents were as happy as in their exile as they could be. And Hope dwells with us, their children, too, making our lives all bright and happy. Grandfather's Warning. The weather had been bitterly cold, and then had softened somewhat. Afterwards, for 3 whole days, the snow had gently fallen. The falling flakes, though gentle, had yet kept Rob and Bessie in the house and in their room. 'Twas a bright winter morning when the jolly sun rose once more, peeping smilingly over the eastern horizon. Rob, looking out of the window, saw a pure white carpet of snow sparkling and glittering as far as the eye could reach. Now he would have some fun, he thought. Yes, he knew what he would do. He would hurry out, quickly make a snowman in the garden below, and spring a pleasant surprise on Bessie. 'Twas a great idea. In a twinkling he was down in the garden. One big ball of snow was soon rolled up. This was the base. Another, equally large, was placed upon it. And so, in a short time, the body was finished. But the head was still wanting. Hurrying to a sunny spot where the snow was soft, Rob shaped a head and neatly attached it to the snowman's broad shoulders. But arms were also lacking. Luckily, he found 2 sufficiently long pieces of laths. These he fastened in the snowy sides. He must hurry, else Bessie would see him before he was finished. Then all would be spoilt. Eyes were yet wanting, and a nose and a mouth. Only a few seconds, and he had brought charcoal from the kitchen. And there stood Mr. Snowman in all his glory, a masterpiece of boyish skill. Away he went to get Bessie. Wouldn't she be delighted? But when Rob had been working, another had been watching. This was Tom, a neighbor boy. He disliked Rob because the latter, being more diligent, was always ahead of him in class. Now, as soon as Rob had gone, he leaped over the fence, and with a few blows and kicks and shoves, completely destroyed the newly made snowman. Then he hid in some nearby bushes and waited. He wanted to see and laugh at Rob's surprise and pain. Rob hastened back with Bessie. There lay Mr. Snowman, a shapeless mass. Instinctively, he looked around for the author of this deed. There, across the fence, was Tom, laughing and rubbing his hands in his wicked glee. The blood rushed to Rob's head. He would show him such meanness. He bent down and picked up a stone. Already about to swing his arm, he paused. Grandfather's warning seemed to ring in his ears. "You are the master of the stone while it remains in your hands. Let it fly, and you cease to be its master." He conquered himself with an effort, turned, and went away. Bessie followed, and together they made a second snowman in another part of the garden. Tom had expected Rob to throw and to say hard words. That would have pleased him. But since he did neither, Tom was filled with shame at his own petty baseness. He saw that Rob was a man, and that he himself was a mean, a coward, and no man. The next day at school he asked Rob's pardon. They shook hands and became fast friends, and as a result, Tom became as model a boy as was Rob. 'Twas all due to Grandfather's warning and to Rob's self-control. St. Anthony again. "Edward!" called out Mr. Bryce, president of the flourishing firm of Bryce and Sons. "Step over here for a moment. I have an errand for you." In a twinkling, Edward, the 14-year-old office boy, was at his desk awaiting orders. "Edward," continued Mr. Bryce, in that kind, grave manner which was characteristic of him and which so greatly endeared him to all his employees, "I have always placed most explicit confidence in you, nor have I ever been deceived. Your attention to business, your love of duty, your active, evident interest in the company's affairs, induce me to look upon you even as upon a promising partner to be, and feel towards you as a father towards a devoted son. Hence it is that I have no hesitation whatever in sending you on errands such as the one I have in mind now, and in entrusting you to packets such as these." Here the president handed the expectant boy a bulging pocketbook. "This purse," he explained, "contains $5,000 in bills to be deposited at the First National Bank, Broadway. Deposit them immediately, and then give yourself the pleasure of a half day off. It is now 8 o'clock. Report again at 1:30 this afternoon." And Mr. Bryce smiled in his grave, great-hearted way. "Thank you, sir," said Edward, as he took the purse and placed it into the inner pocket of his coat, which he then buttoned closely. The praise which he had just received, and the unusual mark of confidence which his employer had just shown him, made him blush for joy. "I hope you will never have reason, sir, to regret placing such trust in me." With these words, he respectfully left the room and hurried on his way to the First National Bank. It was the 1st of April, and a delightful day. Edward drew deep breaths of the invigorating morning air as he strode along through the crowded streets. So he was free, was his own master for half a day. What should he do, anyway? He thought of this and that and many things, but he finally decided to skip out for a brief visit to the Zoological Gardens to see how those dandy polar bears were relishing the warm April sunshine. He liked to see them plunge into the large tanks of water which were built to represent holes in the ice of the Arctic regions. Then he would spend a few hours at home helping Mother. He so rarely got a chance. But the crowded streets disturbed his happy making of plans, so he turned down a quiet alley. This both enabled him to avoid the constant jolting and somewhat shorten the distance to the First National. It was 8:30 o'clock when he arrived at the bank, a magnificent structure of granite and marble. As he ascended the steps to enter, he placed his hand into his pocket to draw out the precious purse, and found the pocket empty. Poor Edward staggered and turned pale. The purse was gone. "What will Mr. Bryce say?" he gasped inaudibly. But only for a moment he was stunned by the greatness of the loss and all it meant to him. He quickly recovered himself, and, manly as he was, did some ideal manly thinking. "I must have lost it somehow and somewhere," he reflected. "But how? And what counts most now, where? It could not have been stolen with my coat buttoned up tight all around like this. And I suppose there's no hope of finding it now." No hope? Well, there's St. Anthony. He always helps when lost things are to be found. Why, I passed St. Anthony's on the way. I'll just go back, kneel before his altar in the church, and pray. Then I'll walk back the way I came. St. Anthony will help me find the pocketbook, I'm sure. Such was Edward's reasoning. It was not very deep, but it was full of faith. He did not consider that the streets were crowded, and that not even for a minute could such a large purse lie anywhere unperceived. Of course, there was the alley, but groups of children were playing in it always. However, these were no considerations for Edward. "I'll pray. He'll do the rest." That was his logic. In the quietness of the church, he knelt before the beautiful altar of St. Anthony, that saint so justly popular because so sweetly helpful. For fully 10 minutes his boyish heart poured out its simple prayers for aid. "Dear St. Anthony, Mother says you always help. Oh, don't you see I'm in great trouble now? I've lost a valuable purse. Oh, you must help me find it, else I'll not know what to do. Oh, you simply must help, St. Anthony. Dear St. Anthony, you simply must." Such was the burden of his prayer, such its oft-recurring refrain. Then, full of confidence, he retraced his steps, looking about him carefully, yet not at all anxiously. St. Anthony would help, that was settled. Nor did his trust wane as block after block was left behind and no sign of the purse was seen. When he came to the alley, he noticed, in an abstracted way, that a group of boys at the farther end were evidently having great fun about something. As he drew nearer, he observed that they were kicking a dark object about in high glee. "April Fool!" the boys were shouting. "You can't fool us, April Fool! You can't catch us with a fat pocketbook!" And with that, they continued to kick the offending purse about the street. As Edward approached, one of the lads kicked the purse towards him, so that it fell at his very feet. Tauntingly he cried out, "Get rich quick, guy! Put it into your pocket!" "It's my purse! The lost purse!" exclaimed Edward in an undertone, with a thrill of joy. A confused wave of thought surged through his mind about the wonderful way in which saints, and especially one, do help. He stooped quickly, picked up the purse, and placed it into his pocket again, making sure this time that it was really and securely there. "April Fool, go to school. Tell your teacher you're a fool. April Fool!" shouted the boys, wild with delight. But Edward, rapidly walking away towards the First National Bank, did not hear. There was something else in his heart. It was one big, glad hymn of thanks. Something Worse Than Cannonballs. In the good old days, when France was still a truly Catholic country, the garrison stationed at a certain fortress was ordered to take part in the Corpus Christi procession. As the time for the procession drew near, dark clouds obscured the sky. To all appearances, there was to be a heavy rain. The officers grumbled and could not conceal their disinclination to walk in the procession that day. How strange that they should have acted thus! It was the oddest thoughtlessness. Then the commandant said, "Gentlemen, I'm sure that not even a shower of cannonballs would deter you from going out to encounter the enemy, for you are pledged to the king's service and would deem it cowardly, nay traitorous, to disobey orders to march. Will you now let not cannonballs, but a few drops of rain, keep you from rendering slight service to the king of kings?" The words worked like magic. Every officer went and was proud to go. How strange that little things should so easily keep us from the service of Jesus! Let us remember that He is our King. Let's never fear sacrifices when marching along under the standard of Christ. The Power of Prayer. Ah, Father Herbert, there's nothing to it. This talk, I mean, of the children's prayer saving the day. It rained yesterday, it's raining today, and 'twill rain tomorrow and Saturday too. Prayer may be fine in a way, it may be excellent in its own place, but do you really think it will put those clouds to flight? Do you seriously mean to say that we'll have fair weather because the boys and girls are praying for it? I, for one, am mighty doubtful. Edward Winson was speaking. Of all the members of Father Herbert's parish, he was the wealthiest and, in a way, the most influential. But he was by no means the most exemplary Catholic. Indeed, he was far removed from the list even of those we call practical. Lukewarm and somewhat cynical, possessed of strong and uncommendable characteristics, a man who in his religious life did just his duty and no more, Edward Winson, though he knew it not, was in danger of joining the mighty, ever-swelling army of the 20th-century indifferentists. For as surely as carelessness leads to lukewarmness, so surely does lukewarmness lead to indifference, that most lamentable of all states. For who is more incurable than he that has no desire to be cured? But God was about to show him mercy. A little child shall lead them. Only a few weeks ago, the zealous and untiring Father Herbert had solicited Mr. Winson's aid and active participation in the coming bazaar that was to lighten the burden of debt weighing so heavily on his little church. He had, to be sure, approached his stern, somewhat caustic parishioner with no little trepidation. But to his great surprise and joy, that worthy had offered his services with altogether unwonted alacrity and affability. He had assured the delighted priest that both purse and goods, as well as his own personal assistance, were at his disposal at any time. In the days that followed, almost all the preparations had been made. Even the booths had been erected in the grove belonging to the school grounds. But then, to the bitter disappointment of all, it had begun to rain. That was Wednesday. Saturday, the 1st of May, was to witness the long-expected event. This was Thursday, and oh, what a downpour! Was it really never going to stop? Yesterday, Father Herbert had said to the children in his own simple way, "My dearest little friends, it's all up to you. You must pray that it stop raining before Saturday. This is Wednesday, St. Joseph's Day. Go to Joseph. He always helps. Storm his fatherly heart." Of course, the children had forthwith become enthusiastic. They were all piety, all smiles, and all confidence, too. "Don't you worry, Father," they cried. "We'll have fine weather, you'll see. And, oh, we'll have fine weather for Saturday." And with that, they straightway began a tritium in St. Joseph's honor. Sister Modesta at the head, of course. And now it was Thursday. What a veritable deluge! Mr. Wilson, as the head of the Committee of Affairs, had come to see about the postponement of the bazaar. But with a quiet smile, the parish priest had assured him that all would be well, that the matter had been placed into good hands. Then he told about the children's tritium to St. Joseph. This it was that gave occasion to the remark with which our story opens. "More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of," said Father Herbert, quoting Tennyson. "Mr. Wilson, faith can move mountains, as Holy Writ tells us. I have unbounded confidence in the children's prayers. I believe they are going to pierce the clouds in very truth, and scatter them, too." That settled it. Willy-nilly, Mr. Winson was obliged to postpone the projected postponement, and so he took his departure with the best possible grace, doubtful, to be sure, and wondering much, for heavy clouds in foggy England are rarely anxious to flee away at the bidding of any man, much less, thought he, at the feeble lippings of a group of boys and girls. But he would see. and Saturday evening he would call and let Father Herbert have his "I told you so." Friday morning came, bringing a leaden sky. From out of the gloomy heavens the rain came steadily, steadily down. "The children are praying hard," Sister whispered to Father Herbert in school that morning. "They haven't the least doubt about tomorrow. They are sure of the bazaar. They are bringing just heaps of flowers to St. Joseph. And only think of it, about an hour ago the sweet little things came to me and said, 'Sister, if St. Joseph doesn't listen, we're going to turn his picture round to the wall.' What a threat! And what a wondrous faith withal!" And Sister smiled happily. Saturday morning came, and still it was raining, raining, raining. The event had been planned for the afternoon. The tritium was at an end. The prayers were apparently unheard. Could it be that Mr. Winson was right after all? Not so, thought the children. "We'll have fine weather, Father, you'll see. We'll have fine weather." Such was still the burden of their song. Were they not a little rash? Was not this a cause of hoping against hope? It seemed even presumptuous, but it was not. About 10 o'clock, the clouds began to grow ever thinner and thinner. It stopped raining. The jolly May sun peeped down upon the earth and began to kiss away the diamond drops from bud and flower. A warm wind began to blow, putting to even more rapid flight the already retreating denizens of the sky, and gathering up the little pools of water in passing. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, everything was dry. The grass was invitingly fresh and green. The birds in the grove began to sing their sweetest songs, so sweet that the beauteous flowers which had been sleeping since Wednesday were awakened thereby and opened their little eyes again. And the people, dressed in their Sunday best, left their homes in crowds and thronged to the bazaar. Ah, what merrymaking there was then! Such a buying and selling and drawing and begging and fining and taxing and what not. Games abounded. There was business like fun and frolic everywhere. A fair just like it that the little parish had never had before. And the children, they were in high glee. Beaming with joy, they danced around Father Hubert again and again, and ever with the same exultant exclamation, "Oh, we told you so!" Nothing could equal the tender joy that overflowed from the innocent, confiding hearts that day. St. Joseph had been true. It was late at night when the committee, Father Herbert in their midst, assembled in the schoolhouse to determine the result of the afternoon's activities. When they had finished, Edward Winson arose and grasped the priest's hand with a grip as sincere as it was firm. "Father," he exclaimed, "I now believe in prayer. Not only did we have that bazaar, but it was the most successful this parish has seen since its existence. I'm a changed man, Father. I'm going to get down on my knees and do my duty to God from this day forward to the end of my life. I'm going to become a man of prayer." "Mr. Winson, I am glad. God be praised," said the priest, deeply moved. "Prayer can indeed do all things. We need only faith." "But what is that?" he asked suddenly. All listened. Upon the tin roof above there was a patter, patter, patter. The men looked at each other in astonishment. It was raining.